You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Tyson, for those who haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and tell our listeners what we're talking about today.
I'm Tyson Clark, the CEO and founder of Voista Training Labs, pharmaceutical training company. I'm an Australian-American. Around 2013, I moved into the world of pharmacy, and unfortunately, I came up with a training method that has taken over the rest of my life, and I haven't been able to do anything else since.
Is your customer base in Australia?
Yep. So we do, Australian pharmacy is a little different. We don't have the same struggles as you guys, but there's some of the things in the U.S. system are better and are preferable, in my opinion, and some of them are not. But the main thing that we try and leverage in Australia is the natural migration of the patients and the front of shop staff being more involved in your health decisions in Australia versus here. There's a wealth of knowledge in the front of shop. There's ladies who've been there for 15, 20, 30 years, and the community comes to rely on those people as a wealth of information, a reliable health professional. And they're the most frequented health professional in Australia. With chronic disease being the main focus and lifestyle decisions being the main sort of impetus on chronic disease, then I just thought that those front of shop gems were something that we could really take advantage of and leverage for curbing chronic disease in the country, as well as making the businesses more money. That was the first goal, but you got to sell it to yourself somehow.
You help them make more money, and that I imagine is an easier way to get your foot in the door, right? By saying, I'm going to make you money doing this.
Well, I thought so. But pharmacists do this terrible thing where they do everything that talks themselves out of making money.
I don't think you could have said that any better. Pharmacists have a hard time pricing themselves. They're so used to being slapped by the insurances that it seems if they're making money on something,
they must be doing something
guilty
wrong
about it. We gotta be doing something wrong.
Yeah, but I come to appreciate it. One of the things that I'm lucky because my background in cultural change has really taught me to appreciate the intelligences that we have there already. You really couldn't when you're delivering drugs to people. You really can't have a better bottleneck than a pharmacist, right? Because they're such a you could go crazy. You could go bananas. If it was just pure raw capitalism, it would be mayhem. So you really come to appreciate, after pulling your hair out for years working with pharmacists about not making money, you really come to appreciate why they're doing it and why they sort of think that way is because it's more about the patient. They just really do genuinely care more about the patient than they do about the profits. So that was my original marketing approach, is like, hey, I'm going to make you more money. And some of them will take you up on that. But I found the message that when I'm talking to new clients that resonates with them is, I'm going to help you to become a health destination in your community. Mm. Right. I'm going to help you to become a trusted authority that, people will come to see you and rely upon your venue as a place where health is. So you'd think that making more money would be a good lure for them, but it's not as good as, I'm sure every Tom, Dick and Harry is telling them that. So I'm telling them, the health destination's the main focus.
Yeah, and I think that pharmacists, especially that are in, let's say, independent pharmacies.
Yeah.
There's probably no business that does this more, is they understand they're in it for the long haul. And I don't mean like 3 days or 3 months. I mean like 3 years, 10 years, 30 years. I mean, they know that if they give someone the right advice now, in 15 years, that customer might pay off. Now, the problem with today's business climate is that if you don't make some money now, there might not be a 15 years from now.
Yeah. The kind of intelligences that I've seen that pharmacists usually bring to the table, there's three of them that they rely on. Firstly, you've got to have a great memory. okay? Because there's a lot of information there to absorb, and this is what will get you through school. So they're always going to be great students because they're fantastic memory recall. Then the second thing is protocol. They can follow the rules, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's really important too, because if you don't follow the rules in health, then people die. The third intelligence that I see they bring to the table is just like a love of communicating with people, in interpersonal relationships. Not all of them. Some pharmacists are like, oh, I hate it when they touch my hand. Ugh, there's human residue. but they're the three intelligences that they bring to the table. And it's in direct opposition to any confrontation. It's a tough sort of set of intelligences for leadership at times when you gotta kick some butt. My job is to help your pharmacy move in a slightly different direction or amplify the direction that it's going. That confrontational situation is not something that they relish in my experience. And also sales skills is also, you know, you could make the argument that pharmacists became pharmacists and doctors became doctors and electricians became electricians because they had their nose in a book and that made it so they didn't have to do sales skills. They didn't have to rely on those intelligences. So
why don't the pharmacists like confrontation? Is that also because their nose was in a book and things were black and white?
I would say so. The great thing about pharmacy in Australia is that only a pharmacist can only own a pharmacy, and they can only own five. They did get cheeky with it, right? The market always finds a way. So they all joined together, a bunch of pharmacists joined together and made a wholesaler called Chemist Warehouse. But the rest is groups that are, you know, independently, you can only own a certain number in each state. And there's only, you know, sort of six or seven states. So I should probably know how many states are in my country, but I've forgotten right now.
You don't live there. That's okay.
No, so any profession will come to rely on the intelligences that are required for their position. I really get along with electricians, right? Mm. I get along with electricians most of the time. I was driving my car thinking of this yesterday. And I was like, I wonder why that is. But it's because they have a practical application of a quasi-theoretical thing, right? You've got to run through your head how an electrical circuit is going to work. And I seem to really jive with those guys. When I'm working with engineers, my software engineers, it's a different story. They're more theoretical and less practical, and there's no pain in getting your finger in the wrong circuit and getting right. zapped. So, but pharmacists, they tend to rely on a set of intelligences that are anti-confrontational. And gripes about your staff bitching about change, that's every industry. People don't like change. But and so the pharmacists will kind of sort of stay away from that, or any you know, relying on any set of intelligences, you're going to stay away from the ones that haven't served you, right?
Yeah.
So whereas pharmacists are really great with factual recall because they have to be. It doesn't mean they don't care, but the sort of the emotional intelligence might be dialed down a little bit because they rely so much on the visual. And so if you need to be confrontational, you kind of do need to have that, you know, put your arm around them sort of, hey, it's not working out. You've either got to change this or I got to get rid of you kind of thing. So that's a really uncomfortable conversation if you can't meet someone, especially if you can't meet them very well emotionally.
They've probably improved the strengths that have made them pharmacists, the analytical stuff or the black and white thinking and the dosing and things like that. And maybe those things attracted them to that profession. But even if they were well-rounded when they went in, their other skills, not the confrontational ones, have probably increased over time and maybe weakened in the other area.
Well, yeah, and I'd say that's true for any profession, any person, really. Pharmacists flourish in a school environment. Like, if you think about school, it's you need to remember stuff, you need to follow the rules and be diligent and cross the T's and dot the I's and have a good relationship with your teacher, I guess, but so they flourish in that environment, and then that moves on to a later environment. This way, if you read Robert Kiyosaki, he says A students work for C students. So because the C students didn't have the intelligences that were required to excel in school. So I deal with retail managers in Australia, and they're probably the C students, but they've got fantastic skills to lead those staff. Really impressive people, like super impressive retail managers leading a team of staff, and the pharmacist gets to be in the dungeon.
How'd you land in pharmacy then?
After I graduated from Wisconsin, I went back to Australia, and I went right into consulting with a personality analysis sort of cultural change company.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. But I didn't feel like I was doing any work where the rubber was really hitting the road. It was sort of intellectual entertainment. I was good at it, and the money was good.
Because that's your background in psychology. That's what your degree's in.
Yeah, I just got my bachelor's in psych and philosophy, but I've never really stopped studying. I graduated and went back and started working consulting. And one of the clients in that group was the group that I, one of the business owner that I started doing coaching with. So I developed a relationship in that business. We went through a program, and then I think it was probably 10 years later that I ran into this guy, my business partner now, and we're doing some personality coaching. And actually I had a bet with another mate of mine who could have the sexiest tummy in a week. And so I went into my client's store, one of his stores, and one of the staff members, really nice, very, very well-mannered and lovely, but I could tell she just ran out of steam on talking to me, right? I could tell her head was going back to stuck the shelves.
Yeah.
And I ended up spending $250-$300 and to lose a $50 bet. But
now, wait a minute. You're telling me that you had to commit to doing sit-ups for a whole week?
I went all out, mate. We went hardcore. I had a 4-pack at the end of the week, but he had like a 6, so I lost that one. It's not even close anymore.
That's better than I do. I don't even set goals, but if I could set maybe a 1-week goal of exercising, I could maybe live with that.
Well, this is what you do. You talk a lot of smack to a buddy of yours about how you're going to kick his ass, and then you put some money on the line. Right.
There you go. And that does it.
Yeah, that's it. I think after you turn 40, though, you got to extend it to a bit more than 1 week. I couldn't do that anymore.
So you set yourself up already $200 in the hole with this girl. There's no way you're going to win that back. But she ran out of steam.
Yeah, she ran out of steam. And I said to my client, I was like, hey, man, look, your staff are really lovely. They're polite. But I don't think they know. You know, I just jumped online and did a bunch of research about what are they, thermos? About just to give me some leverage, and she ran out, and it meant I could tell, like, if it wasn't me, I was selling myself. If it was somebody else, then they'd be losing a lot of money. And I said, hey, you know, your staff are nice, but they really don't know how to close me on this. They could probably use some sales skills. And he said, and I'll never forget, he had a folder and he brought to our next meeting. He's like, well, actually, I thought I'd tell you about this. And he started introducing to me the rabbit hole of Australian community pharmacy. And yeah, so I started, we got a contract together to do consulting with the business, and we set some goals again. I set a ridiculous goal of increasing his front of shop GP 20%.
Did you give yourself longer than a week?
Yeah, 6 months this one was, but it ended up being probably a year. So we extended a year because we had to do some cultural work. But, it was a bit sort of fuzzy on the details, but, you know, through inventing Voistar and leveraging some other opportunities within the business and recognizing the foundation of their current customers, which painted the picture for the future, I think we really kicked some tail there, and we really We moved the needle quite a bit. So that's how I got into pharmacy.
When you come upon a training situation like this, was it that this young lady had no training, or she was trained not enough, or she was trained incorrectly?
I would lean towards incorrectly.
Really?
Yeah. The funnest part of my job is meeting really high-performing people and stealing their methods and delivering it to everyone else. And that usually creates a new method of training. It makes new training material that didn't exist previous. Because what the Pharmacy Guild of Australia does is it's run by pharmacists. And pharmacists are fantastic at picking up new information. And if they've got an acronym that's 17 letters long of a process to follow, that's just fine to them. But to the average person, it's nuts.
Right.
It's just too much RAM. I don't have that RAM available, dude. So even from the, you know, the highest, the gods of the industry, the regulation sort of kings of the industry, then I didn't see how the information that they were presenting and how expecting other people to do was going to have any efficacy at all. And it doesn't, right? The methods that they do. What are they called? Mystery shoppers to test you to make sure that you're asking the right questions to a patient before you hand over a specific schedule of medicine. And we fail all the time. And so I interviewed somebody who used to work for the guild. What is this? It's called What Stop Go. What does What Stop Go stand for? Like, what's the acronym?
Oh, that's that long acronym.
Yeah, well, that's one of them, but
yeah.
They've got a few, but nobody remembers them. And so I really don't. So I reverse engineered it, and I went into the field, and I found the highest performers, the ones who were doing the work, right? They were doing what they were supposed to do, and I built it based on what they were doing, right? And using the words that they were using, and built an acronym back that way.
Now, when you say high performers, it sounds to me because in Australia, the out front staff maybe has more responsibility, but I'm also hearing you saying that it's a higher profit. And I'm thinking sales. With their higher skills, do they get more sales just because they're so good? Or is it also sales skills you're teaching them?
That's a good question. And that's the question I asked when I went in. Because the business said, look, we want to head in this direction. We want to do what's called, they called it total solutions at the time. And I'm very skeptical. So I do a lot of research on everything. So I never get anything done. But I wanted to test their hypothesis against the patients.
Yeah.
Right? I want to move in this direction. Well, why? How do you know that's a good direction? Because if I want to pour my heart and soul into this direction, I want to make sure it's going to pay for you. So they told me that, and I went out and I found a way to sort their highest profiting just front of shop sales, like just their retail sales, not the scripts. And I found them by the top 10% of profitability, the patients with the highest profit in the front of the shop, just retail sales.
Just to balance this against the U.S., we're talking things like someone out front and someone's asking for shampoo or soap or a box of candy or something like that, right?
Yeah, but they'll get actual health requests in Australia.
They'll get more things that maybe don't even get back to the pharmacist, but it's things in the U.S. that might go back to the pharmacist, like what's the best cold medicine and so on.
Yeah.
They're maybe trained more for these kind of questions out front.
Yep, absolutely.
I can see where those merge more about the health and the financial, because I didn't see how much money you could make on maybe telling someone what flavor of pop they should buy or something. But because those are interwoven more, it's higher priced items for one.
There's a certain intelligence that doesn't allow us to just go for high priced items. In fact, you've got to really sell it to the front of shop staff. But this arc of a story, so I sat down the high performing patients. And I said, why do you love us? What do we do? Why are you so good to us? And I asked them, I did some personality analysis on them as well and asked them where they shop in the field, just to sort of outside of health, just to get a sense of their natural migration in the market and who might be able to make potential partnerships with outside of pharmacy. These guys, they usually said, look, there's Marina. She takes great care of me. She sells me a lot of stuff, but I trust her with her solutions. And it's not stuff, she tackles it from different angles, right? She's trying to do it from different angles, this one health problem. And so that's how, and I heard that kind of answer quite a bit. Sometimes it was people like they were just really sick and they needed a lot of medications, so they were in there a lot. Some people had sort of interesting or unique ailments that only this location, which, you know, they have a naturopath on staff as well, so they could only go there. But yeah, most of the time, the high performance patients were profitable because they were seeking a multiple angle approach to solve their problem. They weren't trying to save money. They wanted to solve their problem. And so that's where I started. I was like, okay, cool. Then I go and talk to Marina. I talk to the high performers. What are you doing? Tell me what it is. Because the content that I started training them was, I realized, was total garbage. I was taking training that I'd learned in the US from retail cell phones and thinking that, you know, it's a copy-paste thing. Well, it's just a totally different culture. So I learned very quickly that the content that I was teaching them was rubbish, but they had some real high performers that the high-performing staff that the patients pointed out. And so that's where I sort of interviewed the high-performing staff. I said, what are you doing? You know, we did a lot of role plays. How would you solve this problem? How would you solve this problem? And they were presenting a multiple angle solution to a lot of problems. For example, you know, for joint pain, we're going to, you know, let's say you've got a problem with your knee and I come in and say, you know, Mike, I've got this problem with my knee. My ideal response from you, Mike, would be say, okay, like in the short term, we're going to give you some ibuprofen to take care of the pain and the inflammation. Long term, I want you to take curcumin and omega-3 because we've got a few studies that really support that being that, you know, pointing you in the right direction. To prevent it happening again, there's some knee braces over here. Look, they're $80 to $120. It sounds like a lot, but if you're using it every day, you're probably going to get 2-3 years out of it. It's going to be the cheapest thing for you. Mm. And then also here's some Voltaren to treat it. You know, it's a scheduled medication that I can recommend. And I'll ask my questions, you know, are you taking anything else? Do you have any other allergies or conditions? So that's the sort of four quadrant approach that I was able to extract from the high performers. And then I deliver that to the remaining staff, the average performers, the ones who haven't spent 10,000 hours in the field. And yeah, we were able to, that's how we were able to move the needle in a scalable way, just by taking from the top and delivering it more efficiently.
It sounds like the information that you're sharing in Australia is great information for US pharmacists or very high top technicians who've been around this medicine forever. Because what I'm hearing you talking about, those are sales, oh, I don't know if we want to call them techniques. I don't want to be too harsh about it, but those are sale things that every pharmacist can learn from this. So say that again, the four quadrants. What were those again?
That's a really fun thing that I took from my cultural change days. Short-term, long-term, internal, external.
Hmm.
Because I use a speech-operated program, they have to say these words. And internal, external made everybody cringe, but that was what I called it. So that's what you're going to do. And then after that, I sort of realized what a problem that was because I was getting a lot of pushback from the staff. And so I started doing panels, and it's almost like a cultural phenomena where I'll go to a business and I'll say, hey, who's the best at solving people's problems? And they'll say, it's Jenny. And Jenny will get up and say, hey, Jenny, I've got a problem with eczema or dermatitis. Okay. And then I said, you know, give me the Rolls-Royce treatment, Jenna. And so Jenna will rattle off four or five things. Then I will I'll put those all up on a whiteboard and I'll write it on post-it notes. Or I have somebody else do it on post-it notes because I can't write and talk at the same time. And I'll ask the staff, what kind of solution is this solution? And I'll give it a name. And then I'll pick up another post-it and say, what kind of solution is, you know, a bleach bath? And they'll give it a name. And the labels come out the same at every pharmacy that I go to. And it became short-term, long-term, treat, prevent. So that's what they're comfortable saying. And that's the, and we've categorized it now into like having their own definitions. We've built a definition that they agree on. Treat is, in Australia, they're scheduled front of shop medications, S2, S3. So that's ones that you need to really ask about, you know, if you're giving them Nurofen, like a stronger ibuprofen, then you've got to ask about contraindications and stuff, allergies.
In the example you gave about the knee brace,
yeah,
and so on, now that I know what the four quadrants are, yeah, give me those examples again, and where did those fit into those four quadrants then?
So the short term was ibuprofen. It's immediate pain relief. Usually short term is pain relief and time sensitive.
Gotcha.
So that's usually the care, and not an S2, S3, if not a scheduled pharmaceutical medication.
Sure.
Long term is usually lifestyle, or it's going to take sort of 4 to 6 months as a treatment, which is why we threw omega-3 and curcumin in there.
Gotcha.
And we have a lot of success with that. I have a lot of success with curcumin and omega-3 now that I'm getting more arthritic and I live in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Your prevention was the knee brace to prevent it happening more in the future. And then your treatment was the Voltaren Osteogel 24 hours because it's a Schedule 2 in some states in Australia. So
that's interesting.
That was the four quadrant approach. Yeah. So that's we don't, like, we train every month, our program, we train a new ailment. Like, we start with the ailment because that's what the staff care about.
Yeah.
And we give them the four quadrants, but we give them the four quadrants every month. So eventually our goal is to build a sort of brick house of four quadrants into the psyche of the community so that if they come across a problem or an ailment that they have not been trained on, at least they've got, you know, how can I help this person in the short term? How can I help them to prevent it happening further? How can I, you know, so that's what we're trying to build through repetition and different ailments.
All of our minds probably go there. We say, how am I going to handle this today? How am I going to handle this a month from now? And then the other one was prevention.
Yeah.
What's the fourth one?
Well, pharmaceutical-grade treatment.
Pharmaceutical-grade treatment.
Short-term, long-term, treat, prevent.
I got you. Short-term is not yet with the doc. In U.S., it'd be like OTC.
You're not even talking to a pharmacist necessarily. You're talking to a front of shop.
Front of shop.
I know it's hard to get your head around.
It's hard in the U.S. because it's almost like we're down a level. It's almost like the pharmacist is doing this because the pharmacist isn't writing for prescriptions.
Yeah, right. And it's free healthcare, right, for the patient. These are the most frequented health professional in the country. So you see a doctor like 3 times a year. You see a pharmacist 14 times a year. You probably see a front of shop 16 to 18 times a year. Because you don't always see a pharmacist when you go to a pharmacy. So they're the most frequent health professional. They're one of the most trusted. They're not necessarily pharmacists, but every year the survey comes out. It goes nurses are the highest trusted professional, then doctors, and then pharmacists. And sometimes pharmacists edge in front of the doctors, but most of the time we're third. So very highly trusted professional and highly frequented professional. And I thought that combination of natural migration of people combined with trust, because otherwise, you know, your barista you see probably every day and you could get health information from them too, but you don't trust them with your health decisions. So, or your bartender.
If the front staff is that well trained, is there another level in the pharmacy of someone who I would just call like the cash register person? I mean, is everybody that well trained in the pharmacy?
Well, it depends on the pharmacy, mate.
I think you're smarter over there than we are here in the U.S.
I think they have a harder job, the front of shop staff. They probably get paid a bit more.
Yeah.
But minimum wage is higher. So I don't know how to correlate that across the position and across the expense, the cost of living in each country and each state. So it's hard to say, very hard to say. But yeah, they are picking up health advice just sort of on the job. One of the best ways they do it is stock take, where you go to, or you're cleaning the shelves. You're looking at each product, you clean the shelf, you're seeing the active ingredients.
Just learning it there.
We really respect and appreciate the front shop position, and we sort of have a goal of turning that position into what the pharmacists want, which is to help them become a health destination. Oh, I'm going to go see her. She really helps me, and I trust her, and she gives me a full solution. The real problem that those, it's usually ladies, So you'll have to excuse me if I say girls. There are some gentlemen who do it, but
sure.
Usually it's the ladies. And anyway, when they're in that position, they've got a real problem with being salespeople. They really don't like sales techniques. And I found this out within a couple of days of training. And it's what led to us to create our software, is that I would, because, you know, you're trying to, my introduction to training in pharmacy was, I was just observing, you lock a bunch of staff in a room and you somehow magically run your pharmacy at the same time.
Right.
And you're getting everyone trained and you pay a guy 10 grand over 2 days to train 25 people. And then the next month, six of your staff leave. And then the training lasts 3 days and then everything goes back to normal. Nothing actually happens. Like, you might get a little uptick or you might get a little pep talk, but nothing actually happens in terms of long-term change. And that didn't sit well with me. And so it was the first introduction to sales, to training in pharmacy. And that was a guy who was a pharmacist. And he was a good trainer. You know, he was interesting and funny, and he had jokes, and he was really good at what he did, but it didn't make any change. And so then I started training staff, and I was trying to teach them cheeky retail sales techniques.
Too salesy?
Let's go with that. Too salesy. Any kind of sales, if you even call it sales or say the word sales, these people's skin starts to crawl. And so, but first off, I started trying to train these staff, at each location, and I didn't want to put the burden on them to run their business and be trained by me, if you know, because I wasn't confident that it was going to work, because I seen this other guy and I was like, this isn't going to work. So I was training them two at a time. So you'd have a store of 10 staff, and I'd train them two at a time, and I'd do four or five sessions that were exactly the same. And then I go to another store. The company had 10 businesses, so I go to another store, I do training sessions two at a time. And I do four sessions at that store, and I go to another store. And so I was getting really good at what I was doing and doing my little sales spiel. But the girls were rolling their eyes at me. Like they were not taking off on this information, because it just didn't resonate with their identity about their job and who they were as people. I was teaching them sales skills, and the method was just so wrong.
Were those sales skills beyond the four quadrants we were talking about?
Yes.
So these are actually techniques or skills to close the sale and do different things like that beyond the quadrants.
Yeah. This is before the quadrants. Yeah. This is what led me to the quadrants, to recognize that my method was wrong.
Oh, this is what led you to the quadrants.
Gotcha. Yeah. So I was teaching them sales skills, and that was wrong. And that, you know, we solved that with short term, long term.
Yeah.
But there was also, I was getting all the skill acquisition here. Right, I was getting the skill acquisition they weren't. And nobody's going to learn anything from talking to a guy and doing one role play or two role plays with him once. It just doesn't work that way. And so that means if they choose to apply it, and if they choose to apply it on patients, that's the only way that the skill is going to be acquired and the culture is going to change. And so I wasn't really comfortable with those odds. And so that was the second problem, was that the method of training was wrong. And so then I thought, well, what if there's a way to deliver to each site so that they get the repetition, right? Not me, that they get the repetition, and I go to each site and they get the repetition, but it's a better method than what I'm delivering, because I'm still getting the eye rolls at this point. Then, you know, it would be good. But then I thought, well, you know, it's not going to work to get a multiple choice or a written answer, because A, nobody wants to do that in high repetition, and B, even if I did do it in high repetition, I don't do that with a patient. No patient ever says, hey, what do you think about this, A, B, C, or D? Or can you give me a written answer on how to solve this problem? The patients need to learn to speak about the problems. And so I thought, look, if I can – I dabbled in programming a little bit, and so I thought, look, if I can combine a better method than what I'm teaching them in high repetition using speech recognition, so that they have to speak the best methods in high reps, it's going to be really hard not to make more sales. And that was the hypothesis.
They have to speak these answers. And so they get used to saying these words and thinking these phrases more than just picking them out of a multiple choice.
Yeah.
They get comfortable with it.
Right. Yeah. They get comfortable speaking about it, and they're getting the practice in the right part of the brain that controls speaking. Right. And so then when they are in front of a customer, they can speak confidently, which most likely, you know, probably helps the patient. Probably helps the patient to have a confident practitioner as well. So that's what we went for, to combine those three things, and that's how we came up with the first versions of Voista, whatever it was called at the time.
Your company is Voista?
Yes, sir. Yep.
This teaches the outfront staff, who in Australia are a lot more skilled than our outfront staff in general, on average, in the U.S. But instead of sitting them down and cramming 3 days into a group, and that group's going to change within 30 days when someone goes to school or something like that,
right,
you're giving them little drips of this every so often, and they're not just reading it. They have to voice it back to make sure that they're comfortable with these phrases. And that ends up in a better experience for the customers and also more money for the pharmacy.
You got it, man. That's a good pitch. You should come work for me.
So a pharmacist is listening to this now, and they're saying, maybe I can get more money out of my customers without being cheeky. How'd I do?
I'll take it. It's good.
All right. Without being cheeky, but Tyson, are you telling me, if I'm an owner speaking, are you telling me that all I got to do is talk about the four quadrants? Or do they have to close? Are there closing techniques that you have to teach these ladies? Or is it just enough to give people the information and then they seem to buy?
Yeah, that's a really important point, man, because when you're on speech operation, you have to be really finicky about what words and techniques that you use. And so it has to be congruent with the culture. We're really culturally sensitive in the actual language, in the intelligence of the culture. So, yeah, because the culture is so against sales, we have to talk them out of being in sales. And that all I want you to do is to make a recommendation. And actually, I think there are some consultants in Australian pharmacy that want to change the culture to be more salesy. And I think it's just a horrific mistake, because we go back to what we're talking about with the levels of trust in pharmacists.
Yeah.
You give that pharmacist a bunch of sales techniques, people smell that. People know that what's going on there. And so then you lose your best asset, which is trust from the community. And so no, we don't teach sales techniques. We teach them comfortable ways to ask questions. Like one of the best ones that I've heard from a pharmacist is they ask, you know, do you have any omega 3 at home? So that if you've got it at home, then fine. But I'm asking you, do you need this? You should probably be taking this before your whatever, to whatever ailment you have. But no, if we can just get them to make the recommendations, if I can get a staff member to make four recommendations, then the patient, if I can train them to do four, they might do three, and the patient might make two, whereas they would have bought zero.
Right.
So that's what we're going for. Because sales techniques, totally wrong industry. And I want to keep it that way. I appreciate the intelligences that are in the industry now. I just want to leverage what's already there and working right now.
Right. Four recommendations. That's pretty remarkable. And like you say, if you can get that down to, well, if it ends up being three, you know, and the person picks two, that's really cool.
Yes. Well, it's like I said, it's stolen. It's nothing to do with me. We reverse engineered it from the patients, from what the patients want, the high value patients. So if you sort of take this story along the line, it's always what the patients are after. And it's got to be congruent with the staff's culture and intelligence and the business goals. And so we were able to sort of end the amount of time that is available in pharmacy, which is zero. Just built it step by step with a lot of failure along the way. This is the fun way to explain it, but there's been a lot of mistakes that got us to this point.
even in our pharmacy, one of our side things is home medical equipment. So we don't bill insurance and all that. So most of the stuff's under $100. Recently, we started putting in more add-on purchases like
concomitant recommendations.
Yeah, instead of just having a walker, we might also have the embroidered bag, you know, and then we have a exercise thing or, you know, whatever. I can't think of all the stuff, but just having that stuff in the pharmacy, our team doesn't recommend this stuff. Just having it. Some people just like to buy the gamut. You know, they like to buy all the four quadrants just in their head.
Right.
Kind of like the electrician, you know, they want in their head, they want to make sure all those circuits are firing. So yeah, that's remarkable. If you can get your team to go down that road, like I say, with us, we didn't even go down the road. We just had it in the store. But if they can go down that road, that's really cool. Is there ever any pushback from those four quadrants, you know, where someone's trying to talk about these different things and all of a sudden someone's like, I don't want all that baloney. Just do this or that. Is there pushback ever on even just giving good information?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I'm not the guy doing it, but I, you know, the front of shop staff tell me, you know, they get the thing, well, you know, I can't afford it. And when you're in sales, and like I've done door-to-door sales in North Minneapolis, like a really kind of rough area, and you get some thick skin, right? And you get to hear no's and you get back up and you do it again. Well, that these people don't have that skin. They don't want it. It's very difficult to get it through their heads. And I've only found a way to do it through brute repetition, is that it's not your responsibility to make financial decisions for these people. It's not even really your decision to make health decisions for them. You make the best, you give them the best solution that you can, and then they know their pocketbook a lot better than you do. They know what's valuable to them a lot better than you do. It might not be valuable to you to have a knee brace because it's, you know, $150 and you think it's expensive, but I can tell you, you know, I've got bad knees and wearing a knee brace is heaven. You know, I'd pay $500 for 5 years out of a knee brace. It's just worth it to me. So it's very difficult to get them out of that because they're so caring and they don't want to rip people off. But that's why we label the quadrants. There's a reason for this. It's a short-term solution. This is a long-term solution. You're not just trying to sell them stuff. You're giving them a solution that is needed, that means something. It's not just like when I first came into the industry, one of the leaders that I came across who was very, very competent, she said, she used to work down in Sydney, and she said, we used to have the Terrific Three. And I'm like, well, you know, it's good to be recommending three things. I agree. But just arbitrary three things, now you're a salesperson. You're not solving a problem. You're just right, picking three arbitrary reasons. And so that's why we labeled the quadrants, just so that I'm not recommending something that people don't need or for no reason. I'm recommending you a health solution for a long-term reason or a short-term reason. And if you don't want to take that, then that is totally up to you. I'm going to keep doing this kind of recommendation because that's my job.
Right. Short-term, long-term, and then
treat, prevent.
Prevent, is that almost long-term?
Yeah, a lot of the times there's a bit of an overlap. Yeah. Same with treat and short-term.
But it might be a different level of invasiveness almost.
Yeah, yep.
I can see with sales, let's say, oh, I'm going to date myself. Let's say I owned a record store or something like that, and you come in and you say you like jazz music. I'm not trying to sell you every jazz player. Instead, what I might do is say, well, here's kind of a morning jazz to wake up gently, and here's something, a party jazz, you know, and here's another. You're hitting all these quadrants, so it doesn't really feel like you're piling on. It feels like you're a solution maker for the person.
Yeah, that's what we're going for. whether the staff see it that way or not, they might just think it's annoying, but whether they like it or not, they're getting this sort of drummed into their head that there's four ways to solve a problem for a patient, at least, right? At the very least, there's probably a million, but we're really good at remembering four things. We're not very good at remembering a million things, which is my big gripe with the pharmacists doing the training, because they remember so much, they've got so much RAM, and the front of shop staff and regular people don't.
One of my teammates just came to me a couple of days ago and said, we need to have a 100-term quiz for our employees, because some of them don't even know what this is when someone comes and asks something. Then they kind of like beat around the bush, you know, or God forbid, interrupt me during my nap at the store. But if I could tie that into sales, what a better way to do it, you know, for my thing. It's like solutions instead of just learning this stuff, just solutions. Tyson, so this is not required by anybody. This isn't like on the way to getting certified or something. These are just store owners that are trying to improve their sales or commitment to the community.
Yep. Yeah. Right now we charge the pharmacy, and I'm not real comfortable with that because I sell a lot of products for suppliers. And so we're moving into a way where we can make it free for the pharmacy. We're testing something out right now with a business who's trying to move into the pharmacy space. Really clever idea that I think a lot of suppliers are going to do now. They're trying to capitalize on COVID. And they could have done it before as well, but they're offering cleaning products that complement psoriasis and asthma. And I'm like, oh, that's really good, because if I come in for some salbutamol or whatever the product is in the U.S., if I come in for this product and the pharmacist says, hey, you know, what are you using for cleaning products at home? There's a product here that can complement your kid's asthma. Then they might be inclined to take that or not. It's up to the patient.
You're saying it'd be easier and you'd rather, instead of charging the pharmacy, you would get the funds somehow through the suppliers?
Yeah, we're trying not to taint the integrity of the training, because we're really focused on the ailment. It's a tough line to walk, but we might have found a clever way to do that, where the, like, say I do have this cleaning product, then I want to complement that those sales by sponsoring solutions that are not my product. So I'm going to train your pharmacy in my cleaning product, but I'm also going to train you on four other products, because that's what you want. That's what you care about. The big secret that suppliers don't seem to understand is that pharmacists don't care who the supplier is. They care about the patient getting a good product and solving their problem. That's who they're accountable to. And so the supplier, whether it's supplier A or supplier B, I mean, as long as it's a quality product, and there's oodles of them out there. Most products are high quality. You wouldn't keep it in your pharmacy if it wasn't. So, but I think that comes to that non-confrontational nature of pharmacists that's been kept a secret.
Pharmacists don't fall in love with like a Nike brand of medicine or a Apple brand of medicine. We're all over the place with different brands. We really want an individual product that's good for the patient.
Yeah, because you fall in love with the patient. Like, I've never seen that with any pharmacist ever. Most pharmacists are trying to talk people out of more medications. Well, you know, high strength medications, because, you know, long term, it's not a great idea. So most pharmacists are trying to talk people into health and out of medications. And this might be a way to sort of bridge that gap between suppliers and pharmacy. Yeah, I don't lie. I do charge pharmacists, and they do make money. Then nobody's ever lost money training the highest methods, you know, 3-5 times a week, and 5 minutes a day. That is, you're going to make money on it. It's going to, but it would be, you know, there's got to be skin in the game for the pharmacy too. And there's got to be, but the supplier is ultimately the one that's winning here. So I really think it should come from them. I really think they should have invented what I invented, in my opinion. You know, if they cared about their client, that's what I think they should have done. But they didn't. But we're going to introduce some suppliers to this in a unique and clever way.
Well, I'm at least glad you're from Australia, because you've been calling me mate during our lead up to this over the last few months. And I thought he better be from Australia and he's not just trying to cozy up to me with a new style of, like, United States slang.
That would be a bit odd.
Is your company now as big as you want it to be, or do you want to grow some more?
Oh, no, we haven't even started. We've only, like, when you're inventing a new thing and finding new ways to sell it and throwing a lot up against the wall and seeing what sticks. We've been in business 7 years, and we're just starting marketing now. Well, we're rebranding and all that good stuff.
Will that road of growth be through this product with more customers? Is that your first step in growth? In other words, for you to grow, you have your product now. Your growth will be through getting more and more and more pharmacies signed up. You're not trying vertical growth by having a pharmacy who already has your program and trying to do something else. You really would like to get more pharmacies involved.
No, the problem that we've solved is scaling high performance methods in a retail environment. And we're only in a few hundred sites or a couple hundred sites. So, yeah, we want to get into more pharmacies. That's the main thing we want to do. We've solved a pretty big, we've got a solution for a pretty big problem. That really I think could replace a lot of traveling sales staff, because if you've got a sales staff that's, you know, I sponsor a product, I want to sell my probiotic in your pharmacy. And I go, well, here's the product, here's the training on the product. I'm also providing you training for other ailments or other solutions that this product has and other products that aren't mine, because I know you care about the patient. I'm going to hold your staff accountable for you. That's my job as a traveling sales rep now. I can hold your staff accountable to doing this training, because I know if they do the training, practicing the highest performance method in high repetition, that they're going to sell more of my product and you're going to have happier patients and be a good business, and you're going to want to do business with me for longer because you know that I care about you. So, yeah, that's the big, hairy, audacious goal is to scale in that manner rather than squeeze more money out of pharmacies. I'd rather squeeze less, actually.
This is a drip of information to these employees. How often then are they coming back to your, is it an app, a phone app?
Yeah,
it's
an app.
And how often are they coming back to it?
Well, there's new training every single week. It's 1 minute long at the longest.
1 minute. That's really cool. I like that.
Well, each video is 1 minute. The first week is 1 minute because we're dropping a lot of information, but then we give you a really easy question. Like, you know, there's these four studies that show that, okay, we'll do a long-term solution. There's these studies that are published in Australia that show that eating 5 serves of vegetables per day when you've got asthma, within 12 months, you're going to see some improvements in your symptoms just by eating more vegetables. And then the question might be, after I go through the research or the relevant research in this 1 minute video, and I'll say something ridiculously silly. So I'll say, this is the question. How many servings of vegetables per day did the study show? And I'll say 17, 12, or 5. And the answer is 5. And so that's the first week. So I've got that. I've said 5.
They have to say 5.
They say it. Yeah. So
because it's audio.
Yes. So I have to reverse engineer the question too, like to the video. What do I want them to say at the end of this video so that it helps the patient?
Gotcha.
So there you go. There's 5. And then the next week will be a little bit more difficult. I'll build off that. It'll only be like a 30-second video. And it'll be like, okay, so last week we came up with a solution for asthma, and it involved eating something. What were they required to eat, and how many times a day? And so they have to say vegetables and 5 servings. The next week will be a different training again. We pay actors to ask a question that a patient would really never ask. We're really just building off the previous week's training and say, hey, you know, I'm wondering what I can do in the long term to help with my kid's asthma. And then they'll say, you want to eat 5 servings of vegetables. And then week 4 is a total out in the cold role play like you would with a real patient. Hey, look, I've got this asthma. I've got COPD or whatever. Give me everything you can. Solve my problem in the best way you possibly can. Please help me. And my actors will do that. And then the staff will respond to that in the best way they can using the 4 quadrants.
A week later, they're talking about the vegetables they learned from a week earlier.
Yeah, they're learning 4 weeks of recommending that thing. So you think in 4 weeks, with, you know, 3 to 5 repetitions a week of this very short training, it'll pick up and they'll build that into their psyche, a 4-quadrant method, but also a lot of information to slot into those 4 quadrants. When I started this business, I started looking into, you know, what are the best memory people in the world? And if you go to these memory competitions and you see what they do, they do that. They build little pockets and they start with their hometown. Like I remember my bedroom and then the kitchen and then the garden and then the hospital across the street and, you know, and that's what we're doing, trying to do that within the community of pharmacy, is build 4 solid buckets of solutions for community health.
Are they answering with full sentences or just one word things the computer picks up, or how does it know they got it right?
Well, that's why we have to make the questions so easy. Now, we're doing this in Australia, and Australian speech recognition is not very good. And I've had
that's all those crazy words you got, the mate and cheeky and all those.
Yeah, so we make the training so easy that it's impossible to get it wrong. If you do the high reps,
you're not trying to stump them. You're trying to get them to verbalize that answer, I imagine.
You got it. Yep. I'm not trying to pressure them. We're not testing them on their, yeah, we're not trying to disqualify them. We're trying to, and it's a real thin line that you have to walk with speech recognition and feedback.
Right.
So they don't actually see the translation because I get too many. I get too many, like, I didn't say this word, and I said a swear word. Is my boss going to see this? Oh,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've had a lot of funny things like that over the years, but no, they don't see it. But one of the fun things that now that we've got a really great engineer, he's found out what we're allowed to keep legally, what sort of information of speech we're allowed to keep and what we're not in what countries. And so in Australia, we're allowed to keep the information for a little bit. And it's really given us a lot of feedback on making our training better and seeing how far we can push the envelope on making things harder or we need to make them a bit easier. And we have like we have some and or sort of logic in there so that we can require 2-3-part answers. And how far we can push that now that we know the legals around what we're allowed to keep. So staffs do not see they have the option. They can see it if they really want to, but it usually just pisses them off. So it comes out default. You don't see it. We see it and it's just looking for keywords.
They might say, have the person eat more vegetables, but your software is trying to pick up vegetables somewhere. And then you say, okay, yep, we've got the answer.
Yep. Yep.
Any move on this to the U.S. or is that too different of a setup?
No, I would love to do it in the U.S. I just, you know, there's pharmacies that I've met with here. And like I've learned that the less sales that I do, the better for our company. I don't know what it is. I live in rural Wisconsin. There is one independent pharmacy within 20 miles of here and everything else runs through the Walmart. Then you've got the CVS's. And so this would work well in a CVS or a Walgreens, probably because I've got the staff. I would love it to go to independent pharmacy, but I'm just not sure. I mean, because Australia is so small and America is so big, you guys have got a shrinking independent pharmacy market, but still 5 times bigger than Australia.
Oh, I gotcha.
So I'd love to move into independent pharmacy, and I think it would do really great things for those businesses. The other problem is, Because of the CVS and the Walgreens, the margin on your front of shop products is totally different. Like, you're not making $20 on a probiotic here.
It'd be easier to go to Australia and sell to these smaller companies that only own 5 pharmacies and trying to go into Walgreens or something and try to sell your product. That's one of the reasons, right?
Yeah, mate. Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. I think, you know, once we become a bigger company, we might sort of shimmy into some of those larger groups.
Yeah.
But you know, we deal in content creation. That's the big bottleneck of our company is content, because every week has new content every single week. We're making new content every single week, and we can reuse it. But I get kind of, you know, we've got really good content creators now, high quality guys, and I hate all our old stuff. So
with the new stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have to replace it all the time, but
yeah,
I think we're getting to a sort of plateau there. So that'll be good. You know, I'll be able to recycle a little bit more confidently using old information. The research comes out so slowly. There aren't too many things that you do have to keep your ear to the ground for new studies and stuff, which is most of my job is reading studies and finding out what we can recommend.
And then what you were saying, Tyson, which makes a lot of sense, and that's what I was thinking too, is the margins really aren't there in the U.S. over-the-counter market.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I took a picture in a Dollar Tree. My wife loves dollar stores. We miss them when we go to Australia. So, we're in a dollar store and I'm watching the kids or something. And then I see ibuprofen there for a dollar in a dollar store. I'm like, you're kidding. How is that possible? So, yeah, I took a picture and I sent it to my partner in Australia. He's like, holy cow, you should buy that and send it to me. It'd be a nightmare with the Australian FDA, but yeah, it's totally different business. So, I don't know if there's room for it in the US. But you know, it'd be a great market for us to tap into because there's five times as many and we're scalable. You know, we're solving a real problem. It's a real health problem. And we're solving it in a way that's never been done before. Ultimately, I would really like to leverage the frequency of visitation even more to sort of help the front of shop staff to become almost like accountability coaches. Right, where you sell like a accountability subscription and I train them on how to do that to work with a patient. Maybe they're trying to lose weight or maybe they're just trying to stick to their medications better. And a front of shop person can have that conversation with them. They don't need to be a pharmacist to say, hey, did you take it? What's the problem? What other habits do you have right now that we can tie it to? Do you brush your teeth at what time? Should you take it in the morning or before bed? That sort of thing. So that frequency of visitation is the naturally occurring force in the market that we're really trying to scale for health.
I'm listening to your stuff and I'm thinking about my stuff with my medical equipment at my store because we don't bill insurance companies for that. And that's why most of the stuff, we don't do lift chairs and hospital beds, but we do stuff that people wouldn't mind throwing down just under $100 on, you know, a walker or maybe a little bit more than that for some of the transport chairs and things like that. But I can see where this quadrant thing would really be helpful for my team because we're not talking about a dollar ibuprofen here. I mean, that might be one of the short-term things, but I've got some higher price things that I could see using this for that would be worth training my team in those quadrants because, well, there's more profit there in certain things. And it takes longer to sell, but there's more profit.
Well, if you're going after one item, there's another thing we do where, we rub from Peter and pay Paul. So if we're doing a hero product like what you're talking about, we find the best salesperson of that product or the best top 10 salespeople. And then we go and talk to them and say, why are you so bloody good? What are you doing? And my background in personality analysis allows me to separate the personality from the method. So I can say that, you know, I got selected to when I was in high school. My first job was selling shoes in a retail, but I was playing semi-professional basketball. So it wasn't who I was. I wasn't charming. I just a lot of people knew me from playing basketball in the town. So that's not something I can replicate in other staff members. But
I got
you. If you are, you know, 5'4" and you look like George Costanza and you're selling yachts and you're in the top three for the last 10 years versus a 5'10" leggy blonde that is the number one salesperson.
Right.
I'm going to talk to George Costanza because it's something that he is doing rather than who he is. I can replicate what you're doing. I can't replicate who you are. You're too unique, but I can find out what you're doing and I can scale that. So in your situation, I would talk to the sales rep and say, who's the best store with this? Which store sells the most of these things? And then they can tell you, and then you can unravel string. Hey, what are you doing? Do a role play with me. What's the best method? Then you have then you create some content based on that method. Once you figure out the secret, nobody knows what the secret is, as it's usually unconscious competence. They just, just do it.
Sure, they don't know.
No, so you got to tease it out of them, and it's not easy. But
right.
once you get it, it's really valuable. So then you can deliver that information to all the staff at high repetition. And if they're practicing the highest performing method in high repetition, using speech, the method that they're going to use to deliver the information to a patient, it's going to be really hard for them not to increase sales. So
right.
That's another thing that we do that isn't so sort of culturally intelligence intensive, but it works. Usually our hero product stuff kicks up sales 300 to 400% because they're just it's in their conscious awareness too. Like when you do stock take and then the next week you're like, oh, I remember that product. This patient could use it. It's just like that. It's just bringing it to the forefront of your awareness and you're talking about it and all that good stuff.
Hero products being the ones that are most profitable or whatever.
Well, hero is in that's your focus product. So we usually focus on the ailment in our SLTP training or short-term, long-term training. It's focusing on the ailment and trying to get you to build those buckets. But sometimes a patient pharmacy will come to me and they'll say, hey, look, this is a really great andrographis product, and I think we're not recommending it enough. Can you get the rest of my staff to recommend it? And I say, well, do you have a rock star? Who's your rock star? And they say, well, it's John. And I say, okay, give me John, and I'll talk to John. Hey, John, pitch me on this andrographis. What are you going to tell me, mate? And usually it's nothing special, right? It's just – but it's more about the context and the relatability, right? I wouldn't expect Mike to listen to Tyson. I'm just a – you know, had a quasi half a basketball career and, you know, entrepreneurialism and whatever. I would listen to Mike – who is recommending this product. He does my job. He gets me, right? If Mike is doing this, then the person who is in Mike's position elsewhere will be more likely to listen to Mike. One of the things that front of shop staff and it's a real disadvantage is over corporates and daughter and you know your sales reps is your patients know where to find you. And that level of accountability is massive. So if you give the wrong, you know, so you coming from another person who holds your position, understands your level of accountability to your patients, it just goes so much further.
They remember that advice or if they thought it was just a sales gimmick.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. If you solve their problem, you're building a relationship anyway. So
well, Tyson, all that stuff I talked about doing sounds good to me, but now that I think about it, I just kind of want to sit on my ass and do the podcast, so.
Oh, here, I was excited. I was going to finally make a sale. Good thing I got salespeople.
Put a product out in the U.S. and I'll think about it.
Great.
I'm not going down under to get it.
Oh, no, no, no. Like, our system is built for the U.S. as well, and your speech recognition is much nicer. There's a lot more research because there's a lot more Americans who talk.
Yeah.
So, no, it is definitely built for US, but it would only work for hero products and stuff like that, I think, because
bigger priced ones.
Yeah, yeah. So, what you're talking about would work, I think. The hero products. I've got a real love of culture. And the intelligences that come with it and the language that comes with culture and how it changes. When I moved here when I was 19, you know, and it hasn't stopped, I'm 40, people make fun of my accent. And so and then when I go home, they make fun of my American accent. So I'm always sort of studying, like, just through default of moving here. Just differences in language and culture, and really minor, like Australia and America are not really that much different, but there are really minor differences and they become much larger when they're part of your life. So those are the things that sort of have led to the tiny nuances in language and culture that have really just always been very interesting to me and in the forefront of my attention.
It's fascinating to me, the psychology and its dance with sales, because ultimately what is sales? You know, it's what is branding? What is anything? I mean, bottled water has proven that, and $10 cups of coffee have proven that. There's a lot of psychology behind all this, you know, and it starts with having the out front ladies not afraid to sell a little bit.
Yeah. I'm a part of a group in this little town called Revitalize Our Hometown. And we're trying to build up this little town. And one of the interesting things about culture and money and business is you can make any cultural change you want. It just depends on how much time and money you want to spend. If you don't want to spend a lot of money, then you better make that change very close to what the culture is doing right now. And it better be beneficial to them at most levels, at the business level, the staff level, the customer level, the patient, and the industry. So if you want to make a cultural change, then it better be really tiny if you don't want it to cost a lot. If you don't care about costs, then in this town is something I really hope works across the street, but turned a bar into a commercial kitchen, a bodega, and a pub, like a nice classy pub. And it's going to take a while for the community to live up to that, but it'll be really great for the community, better than a bar. So, that's the sort of balancing act we always play. How much money do you want to spend in this cultural change? If you want to spend a lot of money, it doesn't matter. But if you don't want to spend too much money or time, then the change has to be small, and you have to be able to identify where the culture is at right now. And that's the job of the leader, is to go, okay, well, this is where we are right now. I need to move us up a little bit. Otherwise, I'm going to spend an arm and a leg that I don't have.
They're going to spend the money they don't have, or if they can't pick out little changes, they're just going to give up on the process altogether.
Yeah.
Tiny changes is, especially for that staff, like we talked about, that you come in and then a third of the staff is gone in a couple months, and you start all over again. So those tiny changes seem to be the answer, especially when it comes with the crazy world of retail stuff.
Well, that's why it's really useful to know the intelligence strengths. So I'm pretty comfortable recognizing the intelligences of pharmacists, but also front of shop have their kinds of intelligences and their, cultural identity. They don't identify as salespeople. Well, I better not use that word anymore, unless I want to spend a boatload of cash on turning them into salespeople, sacrificing the level of trust that they have at the same time. I don't think, so regardless, I don't want to do that. But understanding their intelligences and their identity, if you want to move a culture, you got to understand both those things before you implement a change. And then you got to throw it up against the wall, because as soon as you squeeze a little bit of creativity out of the group, they've got a little bit of engagement. Hey, because every business owner knows this trick, right? You'll get somebody who pitches you an idea, and then you say, I'm going to tell my team about it, see how that cool they are. Because if your team's not cool with it, guess who's got to do it? You. Right. And if you've got to do it as the business owner, guess what? It's probably not going to get done. So every business owner knows that trick. But to implement it with cultural change as well is another cheeky trick, another little shortcut to get the change happening with some engagement and creativity.
Can I call you mate as I end up here?
No, I'll be very offended by that. Please don't ever use that word. It's disgusting.
Well, Tyson, it's fascinating stuff. I know that in Australia, with the higher price things and maybe the higher skill necessary for out front puts us in a bit of a different category. But I think in the US, I think we can all learn from this, because even though the profit may not be there, if this is not a sales technique, but truly a way to help people, that's all in all not a really bad way to look at things. Of always thinking, when this customer comes in, even though it may not be financial, how can I look at these four areas of their life and lend a hand? And maybe it doesn't pay off, because maybe the total sale is only, $30 and $3 profit, but you've helped a pharmacy in the US say, I'm a problem solver for them.
Right. Yep.
And during this time when, maybe the profit's not there a lot of times, but if you can try to build that trust up, you can keep that trust up. There's other ideas and business opportunities and so on. And so I think there's a lot of value there.
Yep. Thanks. Well, I think this, the same thing could apply in the US, but it's going to take some research and curiosity, and just sort of a weird way of a weird background of experiences and a different way of looking at things. But we haven't really done anything outlandish. It's new. But we've gone right to the patient, then we've gone to the staff, and then we've gone to the, you know, the high performing staff, then we've gone to the middle performing staff, and then we've gone to the training method, and that's it. Like, we've just sort of adjusted things a little bit along the way, and then adjusted the training content to suit the culture. So it's just a lot of little changes based on some really basic curiosity and research.
There's a lot of things that pharmacists may want to bring into their independent pharmacy in the U.S. They just haven't done it because they said, my customers are used to spending $5. They don't want to spend $100 for this continual weight loss thing or smoking cessation or some other things that this could be the answer for, or help some of those things. To have a pharmacist say, we don't do sales, but it's like, well, if you solve problems, then maybe you get some of those, you know, hero products for those different categories. Because I always say pharmacy in the U.S. is kind of like cancer diagnosis. You know, it's like right now things aren't great, but you hold on for a few months and different treatments come and things like that. And so this is a way to move some of that through. Well, thanks a lot, Tyson. That was interesting.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me, Mike. Thank you.
Pleasure meeting you. And I look forward to keeping in touch, mate. How is that?
I'll let it pass.
All right, Tyson.
Cheers.
Thanks. We'll talk
again.
Mate. Yeah, bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.